Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to IRIS today and to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 24th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Looking at the weather forecast first thing, this coming from KCRG. The backdoor cold front that we've been experiencing is on the way today, carrying a somewhat cooler air mass with it. The front, called backdoor, because it travels generally from east to west, rather than the more typical west to east trajectory, will clear past our northeast zone by mid-morning. Areas from Waterloo to Iowa City will be past the front by mid-afternoon, and all will be behind it by this evening at the latest. You'll know when it's past your area when winds pick up out of the east with gusts between 20 to 30 miles per hour, possible at maximum. Where the front passes first today, highs will be limited to the mid-70s. Most of the area, though, will still be able to reach the low to mid-80s. Some clouds may develop along the cold front by this afternoon, with an extremely low chance of an isolated shower. Temperatures for Thursday will be in the upper 60s to lower 70s, with the warmest readings occurring the farther south and west you go. Winds will gradually shift back to a more southeasterly direction on Friday. So, despite a start in the low to mid-40s, we should actually be at least a few degrees warmer by the afternoon. Looking ahead to the Memorial Day holiday weekend, things look pretty nice. Temperatures will be warmer, likely in the upper 70s to low 80s throughout, but humidity levels should still remain reasonable. Precipitation now looks quite unlikely, allowing any events or plans outdoors to take place without interruption from the weather. A slight chance for showers and storms is present on Tuesday next week, with the potential that we may be adding additional chances into the middle of next week. That comes with increasing temperatures and humidity, with highs in the upper 80s for many by then. Looking at the front page of the Courier today, we have a large photograph of two men in shadows with fishing lines, and there's a roof form above them, and we see green trees and a river in the background. And the caption says, "Fishermen cast their lines under the U.S. Highway 218 overpass on Brinker Lake in George Wyeth State Park on Tuesday." The articles that we have to read on the front page include, "Auditor brings concerns to public," "Fire chief finalist meets the public," and let's begin reading the top story, "Debt ceiling talks grind on." But Republicans say there's a lack of urgency from the White House. This story comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. Debt ceiling negotiators for President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy traded more budget-cutting ideas at the Capitol Tuesday, but Republicans warned of a, quote, lack of urgency at the White House to resolve the standoff in time to avert a potentially chaotic federal default. With barely a week to go before a deadline as soon as June 1st, the Democratic president and the Republican speaker were staring down a financial crisis. Failure to strike a deal would be unprecedented and certain to throw U.S. financial markets into turmoil, inflicting economic pain at home and abroad. Markets sank Tuesday with no deal in sight. Quote, "We're not there yet," McCarthy said at a Capitol, reiterating he won't bring any bill forward that doesn't spend less than we spent this year. And here we have a photograph of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy speaking to a gaggle of reporters, the fingers of his hands intertwined in a gesture. Behind closed doors, McCarthy urged his slim House Republican majority to, quote, "just stick together," despite their own factions, as he negotiates the strongest deal possible for conservatives, said lawmakers exiting the private session. He told reporters the teams are eyeing creative ways of rolling back spending that all sides can accept. Quote, "I believe we can still get there, and get there before June 1st, McCarthy, a Republican from California, said at midday. Dragging into a third week, the negotiations over raising the national debt limit, now at $31 trillion, were never supposed to arrive at this point. From the White House, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said it was ridiculous to suggest Biden wasn't acting with urgency. Quote, "He wants to see this done as soon as possible," she said. The White House insisted early on it was unwilling to barter over the need to pay the nation's bills, demanding that Congress simply lift the ceiling, as it has done many times before, with no strings attached. But the newly elected speaker urged the president at an Oval Office meeting in February to come to the negotiating table on a budget package that would reduce spending to reduce ballooning deficits in the post-COVID era in exchange for the vote to allow future debt. Both men said after a crucial meeting late Monday at the White House, after the president returned from the Group of Seven summit in Japan, that talks were productive. But with time short to strike a deal, they are laboring to come up with a compromise that could be approved quickly by the Republican House and the Democratic Senate, and be signed into law. Negotiations are focused on finding agreement over a 2024 budget year limit. Republicans have set aside their demand to roll back spending to 2022 levels, but say that next year's government spending must be less than it is now. But the White House instead is offering to freeze spending at current 2023 numbers. Agreement on that top-line spending level is vital. It would enable McCarthy to deliver spending restraint for conservatives while not being so severe that it would chase off the Democratic votes that would be needed in the divided Congress to pass any bill. Quote, "We are holding firm to the Speaker's red line," said a top Republican negotiator, Representative Garrett Graves of Louisiana. Quote, "Which is that we will not do a deal unless it spends less money than we're spending this year," unquote. The White House continues to argue that deficits can be reduced by ending tax breaks for wealthier households and some corporations. But McCarthy said he told the president at their February meeting that raising revenue from tax hikes is off the table. Negotiators are now also debating the duration of a 1% cap on annual spending growth going forward, with Republicans dropping their demand for a 10-year cap to 6 years, but the White House offering only 1 year for 2025. Typically, the debt ceiling has been lifted for the duration of a budget deal, and in this negotiation, the White House is signaling for a 2-year agreement that would push past the presidential elections. Another main Republican negotiator, Representative Patrick McHenry of North Carolina, who joined the speaker at the Oval Office Monday evening, said, quote, "What I sense from the White House is a lack of urgency," unquote. But on the Senate side, Republican leader Mitch McConnell said, quote, "Look, I think everybody needs to relax," unquote. Traveling in his home state of Kentucky, McConnell said of the back and forth, quote, "This is not that unusual," unquote. However, time is growing short. The House Speaker promised lawmakers that he will abide by the rule to post any bill for 72 hours before voting, making any action doubtful until the weekend, just days before the potential deadline. The Senate would also have to pass the package before it could go to Biden's desk to be signed. McCarthy faces a hard right flank in his own party that is likely to reject any deal, and that has led some Democrats to encourage Biden to resist any compromise with the Republicans and simply invoke the 14th Amendment to raise the debt ceiling on his own, an unprecedented and legally fraught action the president has resisted for now. On Tuesday, the leader of the conservative House Freedom Caucus, Representative Scott Perry, said, quote, "We all want to stick together, but again, it's sticking together around the right thing," he said. He and others are skeptical of the June 1st deadline that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said is when, quote, "it is highly likely the government will be unable to pay all the nation's bills." Treasury said Tuesday it is keeping in close contact with federal agencies on their planned spending as it monitors cash flows. Our next article was written by Tom Barton of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. It's titled, Auditor Brings Concerns to Public. Watchdog role will be restricted if bill is signed. And it begins with a photograph of Rob Sand shaking hands with audience members in an auditorium. Dateline Cedar Rapids. Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand held news conferences, met with lawmakers, and gathered letters from bipartisan leaders to try to stop a bill that would limit his access to state records. But despite strong condemnation from nonpartisan and bipartisan auditors and CPA organizations, Republican lawmakers last month passed the bill, with Senate File 478 now sitting on Governor Kim Reynolds' desk awaiting her expected signature. Sand is taking his case on the road. He fielded questions from a small crowd in Cedar Rapids Tuesday, where he shared his opposition to the bill and urged Iowans to contact the governor's office to voice their own concerns and opposition. The lone Democrat elected to statewide office, Sand said the bill, quote, is about politics and protecting insiders, unquote. Quote, when you give people in positions of power and trust the ability to hide corruption and waste that happens when they're responsible for, they will, he said. That's what this bill does, bottom line, unquote. Republicans have denied claims the bill is a personal attack meant specifically to target Sand, and say the bill protects Iowans' personal information and puts into state law general accounting standards. However, critics of the legislation include the National State Auditors Association, the Institute of Internal Auditors, and former U.S. Comptroller General David Walker, who served both Democratic and Republican presidents. They say the legislation would hamper the state auditor's ability to prevent fraud and misuse of taxpayer funds. Within 24 hours of its passage, about half of the country's state auditors, Republicans and Democrats, signed a letter from Connecticut State Auditor John Garagosian, president of the National State Auditors Association, on the association's behalf that states the bill, quote, will negatively impact Auditor Sand's ability to independently and sufficiently perform his audit work. Quote, state auditors should have unfettered access to confidential records to ensure that state agencies are following their policies and procedures and state and federal law, the letter reads. The bill would restrict what private documents the auditor is allowed to access when auditing taxpayer-funded programs and activities, and makes changes to the state auditor's subpoena power. The bill directs disputes over access to records between government offices and agencies to a 3-member arbitration panel rather than a court. The arbitration panel's ruling would be final, with the auditor no longer able to challenge the decision in court. The arbitration panel is comprised of the auditor's office, the State Department or agency that is being investigated, and a representative of the governor's office. Sand said that would allow any agency being audited to hide records from the auditor's office as long as the governor agrees, erasing the auditor's access to Iowa courts for independent review. Quote, this bill doesn't just restrict our office from reaching the courts. It removes the courts as a check on the executive branch, Sand said. A fiscal analysis by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency warns Senate File 478 could limit the ability of the state auditor to perform oversight on programs that total more than $12 billion. The agency warns the bill may limit the scope of an audit performed by the auditor's office, which could impact the state's ability to comply with federal award requirements. Denial of information requested by the auditor's office for an audit would lead to a modified opinion stating the office was unable to obtain all documents needed to sufficiently audit to federal standards. That could potentially lead to federal agencies withholding, suspending, or disallowing cash payments to the state through programs such as Medicaid, Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and others. Quote, the watchdog still has teeth, Senator Mike Busolo, the bill's floor manager and a Republican from Ankeny, said on the Senate floor. Quote, it's just making sure that those teeth aren't getting sank into something they shouldn't be in, which is Iowans' most personal and private information, unquote. LSA notes, Iowa code and federal law already maintain the strict confidentiality of information and records obtained during the course of an audit, including medical and student education records. Auditors also are subject to the same restrictions and penalties as the custodian of records for improper disclosure. Sand said he has reached out to Reynolds' office seeking to discuss the bill and his concerns, but has received no response. Reynolds' office did not respond to a message Tuesday seeking comment. Quote, the auditor's office is part of the executive branch, and I think Iowans expect the executive branch to be able to work things out. It puts a process in place that allows us to do that, Reynolds said during an appearance on Iowa PBS, Iowa Press, earlier this month. Quote, if my agencies have some conflict, we bring them in, we set them down, and we ask them to work it out, and to go to the courts to have executive branch agencies competing against each other, the taxpayers have to pay for it twice, she said. Quote, and I just don't think it's unreasonable that we can't come to some resolution through the arbitration process, unquote. Reynolds has until June 2nd to sign the bill. Should the bill become law, Sand said he and his office, quote, are going to do what we've always done, unquote. We're going to ask for documents that we ask for. We're going to audit the things we think need to be audited, he said. And if they want to deny us access to records, we'll cross those bridges, unquote. Next, we have an article written by Andy Malone. Cedar Falls Fire Chief finalist Chris Ledecker shares background and views with the public. Dateline Cedar Falls. Chris Ledecker zeroed in on the chance to become fire chief in Cedar Falls as an opportunity that had a significant benefit. And here we have a photograph of Chris Ledecker speaking to an audience. There are Cedar Falls Police and Cedar Falls Fire placards behind him. Most recently, he spent time as the fire chief of departments in Kansas and Arkansas. After completing some due diligence on the Cedar Falls operation, he told a tiny gathering of five residents during a public meet and greet Monday at the Public Safety Center that he decided it would be the right time for him to return home if selected for the job. The 24-year fire service veteran has been chief of many departments, but has never fought fires in Iowa. He had lived in Iowa until age 7 and still has family spread across the state. And he's now one of two left in the running to replace retired Chief John Bostwick. Ledecker has skipped around to 13 volunteer and paid departments in 4 different states over his career. Quote, Iowa's always been home. We'll always be home. And I always wanted to get back here, he said. He emphasized during questioning from the audience that he gained value over the years, racking up as many credentials and certifications as possible, and learning as much as he could from different departments. Quote, I think if you're going to be in an elevated position, you don't have to know everything, because you won't. But you at least have to be prepared, Ledecker said. Except for a stint in the Northwest Arkansas Regional Airport Fire Department, he hasn't been a part of a public safety system like the one in Cedar Falls. The department has public safety officers that include police and firefighters cross-trained to assist each other on the scene. He has emergency medical services experience, but he has never been trained as a professional police officer, nor has he responded to emergencies in Iowa. But he doesn't see that as an indictment on his candidacy and thinks fire service is essentially fire service, no matter the model or state. Quote, I had my concerns. I'm used to traditional fire department, but it was something I really wanted to delve into, and I did, he said. Quote, then I got over here. You really hear those thoughts put together, and you wait a second and realize this is really not much different than what we do now, he said. We just don't call it the same thing. Just because it's a specific model, it shouldn't affect, and I don't see it affecting, the services that we provide, unquote. While in Arkansas, Ledecker said he came across many volunteer firefighters who are, quote, also police officers, and vice versa. The reason why you'll see that is because in the Arkansas pension system, police and fire, you can double dip. You can work full-time in one place and either part-time or volunteer at another place. It doesn't matter if it's fire or police. And you can get 2 years of retirement in 1 year. You'll actually see that a lot, he said. And a lot of times in his experience, fire and police officers will be working on scene together anyway, even if not part of a model similar to Cedar Falls, whether that be for a fire or a motor vehicle accident. This PSO system just brings them even closer, Ledecker said. He didn't come to the meet and greet with any outside-the-box ideas or initiatives for change. Instead, he would allow a 3 to 6 month observation period before proposing anything new. However, he was peppered with questions on topics ranging from recruitment and the compressed air foam system to community involvement and diversity within the department. He had been the fire and emergency medical services chief for the similarly sized Arkansas City Fire Department in Kansas, until a few months ago when he was reportedly forced out. He addressed that situation Monday when asked by Councilmember Gil Schultz, the only elected official president at the session. Quote, Ark City had a great department and we did some great things there, but it just didn't end up working out like I had hoped, Ledecker said. Quote, and to be honest with you, I got called in and still don't know why. They said they're going in a different direction, and that's all I got, unquote. He's had experience working as a professional full-time firefighter in departments, but also addressed Schultz's inquiries about him having jumped around to part-time and volunteer roles. Quote, it was opportunity, experience, and to build my pension is why I did that, said Ledecker. Right now, he isn't working full-time in any capacity. He's currently a reservist for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and is only deployed for large-scale incidents as an individual assistance cadre. Prior to meeting the public, Ledecker had interviewed with the city's top officials, as well as others outside the city in the public safety and emergency management realms. Additionally, he met with community leaders and retirees, along with union members and public safety supervisors. Ledecker was one of two finalists drawn from 11 applicants. The other finalist is Acting Fire Chief John Solendek, who met with the public on Tuesday. Public Safety Director Craig Berti will make a recommendation to City Administrator Ron Gaines and Mayor Rob Green. They will interview the finalists along with Mayor Pro Temp Simon Harding and Public Safety Committee Chairperson Dustin Ganfield, before a final recommendation to the City Council is put up for approval as soon as June 5th. And now we turn the page to the Cedar Valley section and the top article, Names, Details Released in Fatal Crash Monday North of Waterloo, story filed by Jeff Reinitz, and begins with the photograph of emergency equipment parked at the side of the road and an emergency EMT worker walking up. Dateline Waterloo. Authorities have released the identities of two drivers who died in a Monday morning head-on crash on Highway 63 Logan Avenue. According to Waterloo Police, William Smith, 58, and Amy Bowers, 31, died at the scene. Both were Denver residents who were driving separate vehicles. Bowers's two children, a 5-year-old boy and a 9-year-old girl, were passengers in her vehicle and were taken to Unity Point Health Allen Hospital for minor injuries. According to the accident report, witnesses told police Bowers was driving a GMC Envoy north on Highway 63 when the vehicle swerved toward the southbound lanes, briefly recovered, and then returned to the south lanes and collided head-on with Smith's southbound Ford F-150 pickup. Smith had tried to brake, but wasn't able to avoid the crash, witnesses told police. Next, name released in Sunday's stabbing death, filed by Jeff Reinitz, and begins with the photograph of a residence with a police car in the drive. Dateline Waterloo. Authorities have identified the woman who died in a Sunday night stabbing in Waterloo. Waterloo police identified the deceased as 54-year-old Roberta Nagy, who lived in Apartment D at 217 Faraday Court. Police and paramedics were called to Nagy's apartment at about 8:04 p.m. Monday and found her inside, unresponsive, with several knife wounds. Paramedics began life-saving measures, and she was taken to Unity Point Health Allen Hospital, where she was pronounced dead. No arrests have been made in her death, and the investigation is continuing. Anyone with information is asked to call the Waterloo Police Detective Division at area code 319-291-4340, number 3, or Cedar Valley Crime Stoppers at 855-300-TIPS. This is the second homicide in Waterloo for 2023. In January, 56-year-old Mac Bass was fatally stabbed in an altercation in the 500 block of Dawson Street. No arrests have been made in the slaying. Next, Foster Youth Graduation Open House celebrates local success stories, filed by Donald Promnitz, and begins with the photograph of Helen Jean Marshall and her foster mother, Sonia Tharp, as they pose for a picture in front of their house. Dateline Waterloo. Within less than 2 years, Helen Jean Marshall lost both of her parents, but without the amazing people who stepped into her life, it could have been far worse. First, her father, Dean, died in 2018, and then in 2020, her mother, Angel, also passed away. Marshall was placed in foster care for a little over a year before she was taken in by Cliff and Sonia Tharp of Rhinebeck. The experience not only got her out of a terrible spot, but completely changed her perspective. Quote, "I loved it because I had kids that were around my age in the home," Marshall said. "They taught me how to get life skills. We had fun. We did a lot of fun things like go on family vacations, hang out, all that type of stuff. They even threw me a graduation party after graduation," unquote. The Tharps also allowed Marshall to have constant contact and involvement with her older brother, Dean Jr., who wasn't in a position at the time to be able to act as her guardian. They were supportive throughout her time with them, and, according to her, the steps they took allowed her to heal. Now aged out of the foster care system, Marshall says she still considers her foster parents and siblings her family. They're still people she can turn to and fall back on as she embarks on going to college and work. Quote, "At first when I got into foster care, I really didn't want to be in foster care because I wanted to be with family," Marshall said. Quote, "But now that I aged out, I see that it actually gave me a new look on life," unquote. On June 1st, from 4 to 5:30 p.m., success stories like Marshall's are being honored at the Van G. Miller Adult Learning Center during the 15th Annual Foster Care Youth Graduation Celebration. According to Michelle Cooper, a transition planning specialist for the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services, the event provides practical gifts for graduates that they can use as they prepare for college or moving into their own apartments. 6 foster youth are expected to participate in the open house, which the public is invited to attend. The Adult Learning Center is located at 120 Jefferson Street. Cooper added that Only 56% of children in the U.S. who go into foster care end up graduating from high school, while only 3% graduate from college. Older teenagers may move around from school to school and district to district for various reasons, with each school system having different credit requirements. The stress involved in constant moves and decreased involvement that comes as a result of these changes can also be a factor, so the celebration is recognizing a major achievement for the students. Quote, "It's a huge accomplishment for them, and we absolutely want to recognize that, support them, and make a big deal about it," Cooper said. "Definitely." Marshall added that events like this are a reminder that foster care is not the end of the road, and they deserve to celebrate with their peers. Quote, "It's a new look on life. People are willing to help you, and it's nice to go to an event like that because my grandmother showed, and she was proud," Marshall said. Quote, "I know my parents would have been proud of me as well for being such a young adult," unquote. Donations are being accepted to procure practical gifts for the students. Checks made payable to Success Link to help cover the cost of the group gift can be sent to Ellen Vanderloo at 3608 Inverness Road, Waterloo, Iowa, 50701. Additional information is available by calling Vanderloo at area code 319-290-0005. Now, listeners, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 24th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. In Independence, Sally Ann Cresser, 76 years old, of Independence, Iowa, and formerly of Waterloo, Iowa, and Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, died Monday, May 22nd, at Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, of natural causes. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, May 26th, at St. Athanasius Catholic Church in Jessup, Iowa. Visitation will be from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. Thursday, May 25th, at the White Funeral Home in Jessup, where there will be a rosary at 4 o'clock p.m. Visitation will continue for an hour before services Friday at the church. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be posted at www.white-mounthome.com. Sally was born January 10, 1947, in Waterloo, Iowa, the daughter of Douglas Franklin Carpenter and Helen Marie Jensen Carpenter. She graduated from West High School with the class of 1965. On May 21, 1966, she was united in marriage to Thomas Edward Cresser in Waterloo. Sally worked in the Waterloo banking industry and retired from U.S. Bank in Waterloo, where she was divisional operations manager. White Funeral Home in Jessup, Iowa, is assisting the family with arrangements. Next, in Waterloo, Nancy Habink, 77 of Waterloo, died Saturday, May 20th, after a long battle with cancer. She was born February 21st, 1946, in North Sioux City, South Dakota, daughter of Harry and Ida Mae Hogan Frazee. She graduated from Jefferson High School in North Sioux City in 1964. She later took classes at Hawkeye Community College and UNI. On February 21, 1965, Nancy married Gail Ralph Habink at Mapleton United Methodist Church in Mapleton, Iowa. Nancy worked as a homemaker, raising their four children, and worked at Hy-Vee and Payless Cashways. Nancy loved people and was involved in many community organizations and was a caretaker for many elderly people. She enjoyed water aerobics at the YMCA, flowers, reading, and daily walks with Gail. A visitation for Nancy will be held Thursday, May 25th, from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. at Lock on 4th, 1519 West 4th Street in Waterloo. Funeral services will take place at 11 o'clock a.m. Friday, May 26th, at Orchard Hill Church, 3900 Orchard Hill Drive in Cedar Falls, with burial after in Memorial Park Cemetery, Waterloo. Memorials may be directed to the church. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralservices.com. Next, in Waverly, Charles Melvin McLearn, age 95, of Waterloo, Iowa, died on Saturday, May 20th, peacefully in his home. Chuck was born on November 20th, 1927, in Montrose, Iowa, the son of Frederick and Lova Fueling McLearn. He graduated from the Montrose High School and later obtained his bachelor's in science from Iowa Wesleyan College in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. Chuck served in the United States Army as a paratrooper from September 1946 through January 1948, Army of Occupation, Sapporo, Japan. Chuck was united in marriage to Betty Ann Mungovan on December 16, 1951, in Ottumwa, Iowa. Betty passed a month shy of their 70th anniversary, November 2021. Chuck worked for John Deere from 1952 until his retirement in February of 1990. He worked in Ottumwa, Moline, Illinois, and in Waterloo prior to retirement. Chuck loved the outdoors. He was a dedicated husband and father. He spent many summers traversing the trout streams of northeast Iowa with his good friend Jim Miller and made yearly trips to the BWCA and to multiple spots in Canada for fishing. The last 10 years at Tinker's Outpost on Loon Haunt Lake with his son, granddaughter Heather Fitzpatrick, and good friend Craig McCollum. He was an avid photographer and hunter. He enjoyed carpentry and solving cryptograms. In lieu of a service, a celebration of life for Chuck will be held later this summer. Should you wish to remember Chuck, consider making a donation to one of the programs sponsored by the Iowa DNR. www.kaisercorson.com is handling the arrangements for the family. And here the courier lists one death notice. Terry W. Woodstock Jackson, 65, of Olwine, died Thursday, May 18th, at Mercy One Olwine Medical Center in Olwine. Arrangements for Terry are being made with Jameson Smith's Funeral Home. And now, having read all the obituaries, it's time to turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes from Aaron Lehman by way of the Des Moines Register. Encourage cover crops nationwide through the Crop Insurance Program. Iowa is a nationwide leader in a conservation practice known as cover cropping. For nearly a decade, increases in cover crop incentives have resulted in major increases in cover crop adoption among Iowa farmers. The recent introduced Cover Act should be a part of the 2023 Farm Bill to encourage even more farmers. Cover cropping is a conservation strategy that has proven highly successful in promoting soil health and water quality. A cover crop is what it sounds like, a crop, such as winter rye, that covers farmland when there are no other crops planted. Like a blanket, the growth of a cover crop prevents runoff from snowmelt or heavy rainfalls. Instead of the good earth being washed away down the river, cover crops allow the soil, along with all its nutrients and microbial composition, to be held in place. This leads to higher organic matter and nutrient retention in the soil, leading to higher margins for farmers with greater yields and lower input costs for treatments like fertilizer. There are many more benefits, but all in all, cover crops serve the dual purpose of conserving soil and water and making farming more profitable. It's a win-win. At the federal level, the National Resource Conservation Services offers the Environmental Quality Incentives Program and Conservation Stewardship Program. At the state level, there is the Water Quality Initiative, which administers funds directly through local soil and water conservation districts. Private organizations have begun offering cost share for cover crop use as well. All of these services greatly aid farmers to begin planting cover crops. However, they all have limits to the number of years that a farmer can receive payments and or the number of acres that are eligible for payments. Therefore, while they certainly help increase adoption rates, these programs are slowing in impact as more and more farmers have already reached their year or acre limitations. To reach our goal of cover crop adoption statewide, we need to succeed in incentivizing farmers to grow cover crops at any scale for long periods of time. One of the best ways to do this is to provide an incentive through the crop insurance system that almost all Iowa farmers use. Cover crop insurance incentive programs recognize that farmers who plant cover crops are less likely to have crop failures and so, logically, offer a discount on crop insurance. This concept started in Iowa and has worked extremely well here. Iowa is now in its fifth year accepting applications for the cover crop insurance discount, which takes $5 per acre off a farmer's crop insurance premiums. The cover crop insurance discount offers farmers at any stage of cover crop adoption and any size of farm an insurance discount for planting cover crops. In 2021, the U.S. government followed Iowa's model with the pandemic cover crop program by offering farmers around the nation a $5 per acre subsidy for crop insurance if planting cover crops. However, being COVID-related, this program is expiring. Recently, U.S. Representative Sean Casten, an Illinois Democrat, and U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, an Ohio Democrat, introduced the Conservation Opportunity and Voluntary Environment Resistance Program, Cover Act, which would make the $5 per acre federal cover crop insurance discount permanent. This program has the potential to create permanent increases in cover crop adoption in Iowa and in the rest of the country, if adopted. By pairing highly utilized crop insurance with growing cover crop adoption, the Cover Act would be a big step to continue the growth of cover crops in Iowa to meet our state's water quality and soil health goals. Aaron Lehman is the president of the Iowa Farmers Union and is a fifth-generation farmer from central Iowa. Next is an opinion piece written by Randy Evans of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council and a longtime journalist and editor in Iowa. In 2017, the Iowa legislature responded to concerns from Governor Terry Branstad and amended Iowa law to ensure when government employees are forced out of their jobs, the reasons must be made public and not shrouded in secrecy. The goal was commendable. The governor was right. People deserve to be told why. It is called public accountability. Since then, the transparency promised 6 years ago has diminished. Since then, government employees have been more interested in avoiding embarrassment or uncomfortable questions. Since then, government has been less interested in informing the people of Iowa in whose name government exists and operates. Last week, the nonprofit organization I lead stepped up to try to stem this tide of secrecy over transparency. The Iowa Freedom of Information Council and I sued the Centerville School Board, challenging the legality of its closed meeting in February that ended a two-month suspension of the Centerville High School guidance counselor and baseball coach. Ryan Hodges was placed on leave around December 1st last year, following allegations of inappropriate behavior with a minor. School officials refused in December and again in February to share with the public the nature of Hodges's actions. They refused to say whether the investigation found the allegations to be true or whether the investigation found no factual basis for the accusations. School officials claimed they were not required to make public any of those details because Hodges submitted what they insisted was a voluntary resignation. Our interest in the Centerville case is not motivated by some purient interest in the details of what he is accused of engaging in with more than just one female student. Our concerns come from a belief residents of the Centerville district, the people who pay the taxes and sent their kids and grandkids to school there, deserve to know what went on at Centerville High School. They deserve to know how their elected school board and the district's administrators responded to the allegations brought to their attention by female students during the two-month investigation. The public deserves to know what outside investigators learned about allegations of predatory behavior by Hodges. They deserve to know why, after Hodges had been on administrative leave for 2 months, he was allowed to depart without any, quote, documented reasons and rationale, unquote, being made public by the sudden end of his employment, a disclosure the Branstead era amendment added to the public records law. They deserve to know why, if the allegations against Hodges were baseless, he was not allowed to return to work with his name cleared. They deserve to know why, if the allegations against Hodges were true, the school board did not begin the firing process. After all, the taxpayers had been continuing to pay his full salary and provide insurance for the 2 months he was not allowed to work during the investigation. And equally important, potential future employers deserve to know what baggage Hodges might bring to a new school district after being accused of violating parental trust and possibly Iowa law, too. Such baggage has not always been easily knowable for prospective employers or the public. Consider the case of Cody Lacoste. He was arrested in March at Regina High School in Iowa City, where he was a teacher. The criminal charges involve allegations backed up with cell phone text messages that Lacoste groomed and then had an ongoing sexual relationship with an underage female student at Central DeWitt High School in 2017. Lacoste taught there from 2010 until December 2018, when he abruptly resigned in the middle of his contract. He and the Central DeWitt District signed an agreement to resolve, quote, all issues arising out of Lacoste's employment with the district, unquote. Just as with Ryan Hodges in Centerville, Central DeWitt officials never provided details about Lacoste's conduct or what those issues were. Instead, Central DeWitt continued to pay Lacoste and provide him with insurance benefits for the remainder of the school year. The district also agreed to provide him with mutually agreeable letters of reference he could present to prospective employers. The Central DeWitt District did not report his sudden resignation or the background leading to it to the Iowa Teaching Licensing Board. Having a license in good standing and the absence of transparency about his departure allowed Lacoste to obtain teaching jobs in the Cedar Rapids schools and then at Regina High School. The opaqueness about Lacoste's departure shows what can occur when secrecy wins out over transparency, and when school officials are more concerned about getting a problem employee out of their district and less concerned about the potential for the person committing misconduct somewhere else in the future. A footnote to the Lacoste case should outrage parents everywhere. While Central DeWitt Superintendent Dan Peterson insisted he could not say what Lacoste did that led to his resignation, after Lacoste's arrest in Iowa City, Peterson posted the criminal complaint filed against the former employee on the school district's website. That posting included the name of the girl who went to the police last year when she was worried Lacoste might try to take advantage of students in another district the way he took advantage of her. It's hard to understand why the superintendent chose to share that detail, but it should not be hard to understand why there is a need for more transparency about resignations that are not strictly voluntary. The next editorial is titled Paying Our Debts, and it begins with a quote from the United States Constitution as follows. The validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. And that's the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. The last time a Republican House Speaker and a Democratic President reached a deal over the debt ceiling, it resulted in cutting and freezing research into animal disease. In 2015, avian flu wiped out millions of turkeys and chickens in Buena Vista County, and still, nobody fully understands it. We might, had we not starved research. This was just one maddening result of mindless governance. The Republicans tied spending cuts to lifting the debt ceiling in 2011, and Vice President Joe Biden struck a deal on behalf of the Obama administration with Speaker John Boehner that cut and froze federal budgets like the basic USDA poultry research. 12 years later, history repeats. Biden finds himself confronting House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. The House voted to tie spending cuts to increasing the debt ceiling for previous expenses incurred by Republican and Democratic legislation, knowing full well the proposal was dead on arrival in the Senate. It's a game of brinkmanship that threatens core government functions like research into African swine flu. President Biden should not make the same mistake he made with Boehner. Democrats have ideas about how to reduce spending and deficits. So do Republicans. That is supposed to happen during budget debates, not over the debt ceiling, a creation of legislation from 1917. Biden should take a literal reading of the 14th Amendment and instruct the Treasury Secretary to pay government debts no matter what Congress does. Let the literalists on the Supreme Court consider whether they want to allow the House to contravene the Constitution by tying future budgets to past debts. And let those same literalists rule on behalf of creating economic chaos by the U.S. government defaulting on its debt. Budget sequestration from the 2011 debt ceiling hostage taking helped to foster the avian flu crises that continue to hamper production and cause real losses in Iowa. The same sort of thoughtless management led to the shutdown of a joint research effort between China and the U.S. on zoonotic disease, that which spreads from livestock to humans. Such blindness and deafness to the multiple warnings over the years helped lead to the COVID pandemic. The pandemic, of course, led to massive federal spending that piled up debt, which now must be paid. The 14th Amendment says so. The hand-wringing over deficits and debt prompted the Washington Post in a May 4th editorial to call for wholesale changes in the Farm Bill to reduce spending, cut crop insurance subsidies, scrap price supports, quit paying wealthy farmers, the headline said. The Farm Bill was written during the Great Depression. Isn't it time for something better? It is, but that does not mean we should gut crop insurance subsidies or scrap price supports. Something better involves a farm program revolving around conservation that rewards diversity in crops and farmers. Actual spending on farm programs is far less than we spend sending weapons systems to Ukraine and bombs to Yemen. There is no question that crop insurance and other subsidies distort markets. That's why we should reward conservation and agricultural sustainability over production. Crop insurance subsidies should be tied to stewardship. Planting corn up to the river should not be rewarded. Planting grass should be. Allowing careful rotational grazing of CRP acres will not cost anything more and could allow more pasture for livestock production. taking marginal land out of row crop production by putting incentives on grasslands and grazing, is cheaper than subsidizing yet more corn. We can spend less by spending smarter. Merely eliminating price supports, for example, will not bring back the small yeoman landholder. It would simply cut costs at the margins, supporting investment in smart conservation that builds resiliency into our food supply and which tends to support diversity in operations is the way forward. Thoughtful approaches to our budget priorities, unfortunately, suffer from those who frame the debate inside the Beltway. Now let's return to local news from the Courier. Waterloo Supermarket and other Iowa stores receive bomb threats filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo supermarket was evacuated Monday night as part of an apparent bomb scare that surfaced in several Iowa communities. A suspect phoned in a threat around 7 p.m. Monday, claiming a pipe bomb was inside the Hy-Vee store on Flamig Drive, according to Waterloo police. The store was emptied while police searched and eventually determined the threat wasn't credible. Employees and shoppers were allowed to return at 7:55 p.m., police said. Similar threats were reported in Johnston, Perry, and Ames. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 24th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. We want to remind you that you can listen to a recording of this reading and of the other newspapers around the state that we record on our website, iowaradioreading.org. You can do that at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.